From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a top critic explains why YouTube's beautiful messiness makes the platform his favorite place for music. And Julia Sanaa, the director of the new film Loose, wants his movie about white parents with an adopted black son to challenge what we believe is true.
So often it's the case that I think we make assumptions on the basis of our perceptions and our blind spots around people, and those assumptions can have a tremendous impact just on the day-to-day existence, but then on a more massive level in terms of who gets to live and die.
And a new documentary on the Bay Area birth of Metallica, Slayer, and Megadeth, all that coming up on The Frame. With all of the hype around music streaming services like Spotify, Apple Music, and Pandora, it's easy to forget that YouTube is the most popular way that fans across the globe listen to music. Full-length albums, music videos, crackly live performances, spirited comments, they all live on the site and are just a quick search away. Washington Post pop music critic Chris Richards writes that 1 billion people visit YouTube to get their tunes every month, and he explains why the site's chaos may be part of its musical appeal.
I think Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora, SoundCloud, they're against messiness. They want to be like a library and have it be very orderly and legible and clean, these beautiful silos of endless music. YouTube is a mess. It's like a jungle. It's like a forest. It's like the real world. And I find it, you know, as a listener, there's something very meaningful about searching for a pop song and being able to find it on YouTube, but also knowing just a few clicks away, there's Robert Mueller's congressional testimony or a cute video of a kitten and a duck that are friends or, you know, a joke from late night television. It all lives together side by side in this place. To me, that's really metaphorically beautiful. It situates music in the quote unquote real world.
What you wrote about is the strange performances that you can stumble upon. You reference, and we're going to play a bit of Joni Mitchell playing the dulcimer for the BBC in 1970.
I am on a lonely road and I am traveling, looking for the truth in men and in me.
Oh. It's an amazing performance. And one of the other things that's kind of remarkable is I watched it on YouTube, and immediately YouTube said, you should check out John Denver and Cass Elliot singing Leaving on a Jet Plane. So I want to ask you a little bit more about the algorithms and how they direct you on YouTube.
Google is watching you, and YouTube is a Google-owned company. All of your Google life, if you have a Gmail account or search Google, it, from what I understand, feeds into what YouTube might suggest. And it extends beyond just your musical taste. Again, it can lead you down different paths. Sometimes those paths have proved to be perilous. The New York Times had that recent story about how white nationalists are being radicalized on YouTube because the algorithm apparently finds great success in pushing viewers toward more extreme content. If you use YouTube primarily as a music site, it's going to push you toward more music, and chances are it might find something, you know, that you weren't looking for in the first place, which is the beauty of this stuff, the sort of beauty with a sinister underbelly of being watched.
I want to follow up on that, because one of the issues with recommendations and algorithms from places like Spotify and even Netflix is the tendency to promote the known quantity, that the circle gets smaller, not necessarily bigger, and it's harder sometimes to be steered to something really new and different and kind of off your beaten path. Is that also true on YouTube? Does it tend to recommend the familiar, and is it hard to find something that you were never looking for?
To a degree, yes and no, I guess I'd say. Ben Ratliff, a wonderful music critic who has my deepest admiration, has a beautiful phrase for the thing you're describing. He calls them bottomless comfort zones. Spotify tends to obey this principle of, you know, we found out what you like and we're just going to keep giving you more and more and more of it and you'll never leave. I think YouTube, from my experience and again talking to other people, this is very unscientific, is that it obeys that principle to some degree. But by the fact that it has more than just music, I think we're feeding it more information, so it might, by accident or on purpose, send us in a left turn from here, here and there. So I have found that, you know, I've put the same song in Spotify and the same song in YouTube and traced out the next 30 songs that it feeds me. I find that YouTube kind of goes more far afield and gives me a wider variety of recommendations and things that surprise me.
I want to play you another clip, and this is something that's personal to me. 3 years ago, I went to go see Allo Black do a show at the Ford Amphitheater here in Los Angeles, and also on the bill was this great LA Mexican root roots band Cambalache. And toward the end of the show, Allo Black came out and he covered a song written by Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes with Cambalache.
I had a bell, I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land, I'd ring out danger.
It's a great performance. It's shot on some fans' handheld iPhone video. The sound quality is iffy, but it doesn't matter. And it's something I could not find anywhere else because it was shot at a concert.
I think that listeners are very much willing to sacrifice quote-unquote audio quality, fidelity, what have you, for the uniqueness of that experience. In your case, you get to go back and relive a magical moment that you saw in three dimensions. Like, that air actually vibrated your eardrums in real time. But I think, you know, throughout history, we've learned that these formats that are designed to sort of like separate signal and noise are really one and the same. And the noise becomes part of the recording itself. So the fact that it is shot on a handheld phone right there, that low sound quality, I don't know, becomes sort of a characteristic of what you're experiencing. Again, this is an experience that you're not going to be able to have on a Spotify or Apple Music that is just rolling out industry-approved studio recordings for the most part.
Well, it is big and vast. I think you say it's really almost infinite. And as a pop music critic, that feels potentially dangerous, that you could go in there and never come out. So is part of the appeal is part of the appeal also part of the problem?
Does that sound like heaven or hell to you, the idea of being able to enter a musical space and never return? Some things about that sounds very appealing to me. But I see exactly what you're saying. And I think a lot of the other streaming sites try to make us feel very comfortable in the immensity that they have on offer. So we get back to this idea of bottomless comfort zones. They want to make you feel like you're at home and it's finding something exactly for you. YouTube maybe is not as concerned with that because they're not viewing themselves primarily as a music site. So those frontiers, those horizons stay open and they stay vast. And as a listener, that's something that I'm really drawn to. I think a lot of young people are really drawn to it as well for that reason.
Chris Richards is the pop music critic at the Washington Post. He's the author of the article, How Did YouTube Become the Most Popular Music Streaming Site by Sounding Like the World Itself? Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, parents struggle with their adopted son's past and his present in the film Loose. There's a film opening in theaters this weekend called Loose. I saw it when it premiered at Sundance back in January, and I still remember how I felt walking out of the theater inside the Park City Library, which was rattled and unsure. Loose is a movie that doesn't answer a basic question it raises, which is the young black man at the center of the story really a good kid, or is he really a good actor who has constructed an image of what people, including his white adoptive parents, want him to be. Here's a clip from the film, followed by my chat with Loose's director and co-writer, Julius Anna.
When I first met my mother, she couldn't pronounce my name. My father suggested that they rename me. They picked Loose, which means light.
Loose is a student in it's Virginia High School, is that right?
Yeah, in Arlington, Virginia.
Arlington, Virginia, and he has been adopted by two progressive white parents. He has fled war in Africa as a child. And so much of your story is about assumptions of who Luce is supposed to be, mm-hmm. about assumptions about who Luce believes he is, and assumptions of who his parents and his teachers think he is.
If you Googled model student, Luce Edgar's picture would come up on the computer.
Given Luce's background, you and Peter must have faced quite a few challenges. The language barrier, the culture shock.
I mean, you don't pull a kid out of a war zone and have him turn out like Luce without a lot of help.
Which is why this is so difficult.
Difficult?
When you start thinking about this character, this fictional character, and how it applies to assumptions that we make about everybody else, What were the themes that you wanted to make sure you kept revisiting?
One thing is the impossibility of ever being 100% certain. So over the course of the story, you're constantly learning more and more information where every assumption you think or any moment you start to think you're certain, there's a new wrinkle that's added. And that was really important because, again, it's that idea that we all contain multitudes. And, you know, whenever I would think about Luce and the way people approached him, even as audience members watching the movie, and sometimes they would want to get that definitive answer, like, I have to know. And I would say, look, imagine you saw this kid walking down the street and you had to make assumptions about him and actually make choices in relation to him. All you'd have is what's in front of you. And so often it's the case that I think we make assumptions on the basis of our perceptions and our blind spots around people. And those assumptions can have a tremendous impact, you know, just on the day-to-day existence, but then on a more massive level in terms of who gets to live and die in this country. So, you know, it means there's a responsibility we all have. And that was another thing that was core to me in the film. It's our perceptions and then the fact that if we are not conscious and aware of the weaknesses in our perception and the blind spots, there's a lot of destructive things we can do that we, you know, we're not even aware of.
One of the things that Luce is struggling with the most is not only what is expected of him as a smart high school kid, but what is expected of him as a smart Black high school kid. Yeah. And there are so many people who project their own insecurities, their own hopes. He becomes, in some ways, everybody's extension of their own idea of what he should be.
Yeah.
And he, I think, fairly doesn't really know what those people expect him to be. And it becomes an issue for him because he doesn't even know what he is and what he's expected to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult. And, you know, one thing I've looked at, and it's something that I'm so glad has come up in conversation with people, when you think about the background of this kid, he's escaped, you know, kind of the psychology of war, growing up in a conflict zone, being a child soldier. And he comes to this country with these progressive white parents who are hopefully giving him, you know, a future he would never have. But he ends up in this new battleground of psychological warfare where he has all these expectations placed on him by people in the Black community and people in the white community, people in all communities. So not only is he expected to buck the stereotypes of a young Black man, he's also expected to, you know, be this perfect example in many ways. But at the same time, he's Black. He has the privileges of whiteness as a result of his white parents. So you have this constant schizophrenia that this kid is dealing with, where no matter what direction he steps in, he might never live up to what people expect of him.
And a lot of that comes into focus in the classroom. Octavia Spencer plays a teacher named Harriet Wilson.
And I don't know the details of his treatment.
Well, I'm sure you've heard he went through years of recovery and he showed no signs of...
I didn't mean to imply.
I just want to be clear that whatever violence he both suffered and inflicted during that time was dealt with. It's been processed.
Of course. But with the climate around school security the way it is right now, you can understand my concern.
Yes.
Which is why I felt I needed to search his locker.
I'm sorry.
Amy.
He wrote a paper.
A paper in which he describes his belief that the solution to a political problem is to gun down those with whom you disagree.
Right, but he was assuming a character. The assignment called for this, and you...
I found this in his locker.
And she clearly loves her students, but she also clearly has expectations of what they should be and how they should behave based on their gender and based on their race. How much of her teaching is a help and how much of it is a hindrance?
It's unfortunately both at all times. You know, Harriet is part of a generation that, you know, I look at her, she's a more direct extension of the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and there's standards of excellence you would have to have as a woman or as a person of color to be taken seriously and to be afforded opportunities. And what she's trying to do for these young people is prepare them for what the world out there is going to give them. But in the process of preparing them, it also means they have to limit their ability to experience the full spectrum of humanity. So what do you do? We want to tell every kid, you can be whoever you want to be. But if you are whoever you want to be, well, then you're never going to make it in the world. So how does somebody move beyond that? How does somebody grow and mature in that situation? There's no easy answer to that. And I think she feels that if she doesn't prepare these kids for that, then the world's just going to eat them up.
Yeah, but the kids themselves are the victims of that because they don't know who their own selves are. And they're trying to conform to this created identity that may not have any relation to who they actually are or could be.
You know, it's hard. And part of the reason I wanted to tell this story is because that was a personal struggle of mine as well. I'm an immigrant from Nigeria. I moved here at 10 years old. I have parents who are Nigerian. I had to learn how to become American, and they weren't a tool to do that, unfortunately, because of the culture they were coming from. I went to a majority white school and was privileged enough to have great teachers and a great education, and was constantly dealing with that schizophrenia as well. And it's taken a long time to really come to terms with, you know, how one grasps an identity, shapes an identity, and it was part of the reason I wanted to tell this story.
We're talking with Julius Sanaa. He is the writer, director, and producer of the new movie, Loose. When you are making this film that in some ways, in those instances, parallels things that you have been through, do you start seeing what happened to you and the way you were at that age in a new light? Does it change your perception of how other people saw you and how you saw yourself?
Absolutely. You know, it required digging deep and really thinking about a lot of things. You know, there's a scene in the movie where somebody tells Luce that he's not entirely black.
Right.
And that had happened to me in a class. You know, I was actually a Filipino-American student. Somehow race came up and she said, oh, Julius is not black. In the middle of class, and nobody batted an eye. And, you know, the other thing that...
And
that,
meant what?
And it meant that, you know, Julius does not conform to the stereotypes of blackness. Julius is well-spoken. Julius is smart. Julius is acceptable. And, you know, part of that struggle is if... You start to realize if I don't conform to that expectation, then I don't belong here, and I can become easily disposable. And we see that happen, and how that can happen in this movie.
Because there are kids who are considered to be quote unquote black, who are treated differently and are marginalized and are punished.
Yeah, and you know, without, I don't want to get into spoilers, but obviously we see how in the conflict and kind of the chess match that happens in this story, certain people who, you know, might even be in the right suffer consequences that, you know, they might not have if not for the color of their skin and the way they would be treated because of who they are.
What struck me about your film is that there are characters in your story that are trying to judge who somebody really is. And it feels like about halfway through the film, the audience becomes the judge as well, that you have done something very clever and let the audience become surrogates for all the characters in the film. I don't even know how you do it, but was that part of your intention?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole goal of this is, you know, I think for me, what I really wanted to do with this story is play with perceptions, the way, you know, we view these characters. And then at a certain point, it turns back onto us, and then it becomes a question of how we view ourselves and how we view people around us. So once your brain starts engaging in that way of, oh my God, you know, these people have multitudes in them, and what I assumed was the case might not necessarily be the case, then I think you start becoming a much more active audience member, and the questions that we're trying to explore with the film are hopefully ones that carry with you after the screening.
Your film has just screened. There have been some conversations around it, Q&As. What has most gratified you about the conversations, either directly or overheard, that you have witnessed about people who have seen the film?
That they're willing to live in the gray of it. You know, I was very concerned that there would be this absolute need for the overwhelming audience to have this kind of certainty and you know, have their hand held a little bit more. But this was a case where they said, no, this is so complex and so messy, and I want to go home and think about this now, and I want to go home and talk to people about this. There's nothing more gratifying than that, because that was the target we were trying to hit.
Julius, thanks for coming on.
Oh,
thanks
my
for
pleasure.
Visiting the show.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, we know how the Bay Area became Silicon Valley, but how did it become the epicenter of thrash metal music? The bands Metallica, Slayer, and Megadeth are now household names, but such a claim seemed inconceivable in the early 1980s when the bands forged what came to be known as thrash metal. Radio and MTV steered clear, but the feral sound got a foothold in Northern California, which became the epicenter of this musical revolution. There's a new documentary called Murder in the Front Row, the San Francisco Bay Area thrash metal story. It's made by longtime Metallica and Beastie Boys collaborator Adam Dubin. The film tells not only the story of the bands, but also of their fans. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas has this firsthand story. Yes, he was there.
I was among the 100 or so kids who turned up for Metallica's first ever club show in San Francisco in the fall of 1982. I was 16, and there'd be tons of other shows after that when the band moved from LA to the Bay Area for good the following year, finding common cause alongside other young bands and metal fans. Back then, the music spread via cassette tapes of live shows, rehearsals, and demo tapes like this one by the band Death Angel. The music found its audience via snail mail and local college radio. In fact, my broadcast debut, it was as a teenage DJ co-hosting a weekly late-night show called Rampage Radio on a college station in San Francisco.
Hello!
Hello!
We're Metallica, and you're not! You're listening to KUSF!
The station was a frequent stop for bands when they wanted to plug a show or just hang out on a Saturday night.
Got Exodus in the studio. What do you guys got to say about this raging show? You know, tomorrow night at the Mab.
Tomorrow night we're burning the place to the ground.
Oh, that'll be fun to watch.
Yeah. My old friend Ron Quintana, who also turns up in the documentary, co-founded the KUSF show and was kind of the impresario of the local metal scene back then.
My 1980 music sucked. Being a kid in San Francisco, radio was going downhill disco, and luckily there was KUSF, which could play harder punk stuff.
Now here's some Exodus for all you fans.
And as director Adam Dubin discovered while making his documentary, the kids did a lot more than just go to shows.
I mean, they made fanzines and took pictures and made tapes and traded the tapes and built a following for these bands. It was a place any early band playing this kind of music would want to play.
Taping live shows with little handheld recorders was pretty common. You'd make copies of the cassettes and swap them with fans around the U.S. and Europe. I taped this show 35 years ago this summer, semi-secret Metallica Welcome Home gig at the Mabuhay Gardens, a little punk rock club in San Francisco's North Beach.
We go away for a few months, and San Francisco turns into a circus! This one goes out to all our friends! That's a lot!
Also in the crowd that night, a couple of other teenage metalheads armed with 35mm cameras. One of them was Harold Oyman.
My first roll of film, I didn't even know you had to push the button in on the bottom, and I ended up shredding the roll, so kind of learned by trial and error.
The other was Brian Liu.
Another photographer said, like, well, those are just fan photos. They're not professional photos. And I read that quote, and I was like, your point being?
Back then, Brian and Harold would wade into the scrum of flailing hair and thrashing bodies, elbowing their way to the edges of club stages to bang their heads and snap photos.
This one is dedicated to Mr. Brian Liu, whose birthday it is. It's called Metal Militia! That's crazy!
We'd get people landing on us left and right. We'd get boots to the head. I actually broke my leg once down in L.A. I was in the barricade, actually collapsed on me. That's kind of where we came up with the name, too. Murder in the Front Row, it's perfect.
Brian and Harold's historic photos from the era were published in Murder in the Front Row, shots from the Bay Area thrash metal epicenter. The massive high school yearbook-sized pictorial became a storyboard for Adam Dubin's documentary.
It was these photos, these visceral photos of people just mashed together in clubs and on stages and hanging out. There's no record companies, there's no mainstream press, there's no money really. Yet these folks wanted to be there because it was an energy.
Hell's Breath! Which is called Hell's Breath!
Energy that shared much more with punk rock than the hairspray pop metal acts of the day, such as Rat and Motley Crue. Thrash stripped away all that glitz. The line between bands and fans also vanished, says Harold Oyman.
There was this great camaraderie between the bands and everything. Luckily, Metallica were cool enough to let me hang out with them. We tended to drink quite a bit back then. I'd always forget about what happened, so I figured if I brought a camera, I could document it.
What none of us realized was that Harold and Brian were documenting the bruising birth of a music revolution, one that veteran San Francisco Chronicle music critic Joel Selvin admits in the documentary that he just didn't get. In a 1985 review, he likened Metallica to, quote, a dump truck dropping its load while somebody screams over the roar of the cascading gravel.
It wasn't even a matter of whether I understood it or not. I could tell that these people understood it, and I witnessed the extraordinary fervor and enthusiasm. It was hard not to be swept up in it.
And for a lot of us who were there, the Bay Area thrash metal scene represents a lot more than just the music. It's about forging lasting friendships that continue to this day and setting a course for where some of us would go with the rest of our lives.
It was a perfect storm of all the people that we needed.
Here's how Metallica lead guitarist Kirk Hammett puts it in the documentary.
And the amazing thing about it is we were all young, innocent, and didn't know what the we were doing or where it all was going. It just happened. It was like from heaven. It was one of the greatest times of my life.
Oh, here I come. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn of the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.